Hi, everybody. This is Old Buck Dave again, back with none other than
Old Buck Dell.
Old Buck Dell, welcome back, buddy. We both did some traveling last week, different places, and we're both back home now. Sunny Florida.
Yeah. Yes, we did.
Not everybody can be in Florida, as we're going to find out. Hey, with us today, we have Bruce Rettig. He's the author of the memoir Refraction, an Arctic Memoir. Now, Bruce is the author of literary short stories, essays, creative nonfiction, and flash fiction. He graduated from the University of Colorado with a Bachelor of Arts degree in Fine Arts and Fine Arts History. He is one of the founding members of Tahoe Writers Works, a Tahoe area writing group and workshop, and served 10 years as the publisher of Edge, their award-winning literary publication. Rettig's memoir, Refraction, won first place awards in the 2018 San Francisco Writing Contest, the 2017 Pacific Northwest Writers Association Literary Awards, and the 2017 International Chanticleer Book Awards. The piece is based on his years working as a merchant marine in Prudhoe Bay, Alaska. He has completed two novels, and his second, Midnight Stone, was a 2014 Chanticleer Book Review Awards finalist. Bruce lives in South Lake Tahoe, California, writes in the early hours of each morning, and works full-time at his graphic design and marketing and advertising agency during the day. Bruce is the second member of the Tahoe Writers Works to spend a little time with the Bucks. On January 19th, we had the privilege of talking with Bridie Thielen Heidel about her upcoming memoir, Bright Eyes. She wrote a little excerpt, which she called We Own Tonight, which was extremely well received. And she said, I should take a look at Bruce's memoir. And so here we are. Welcome, Bruce.
Thanks, Dave and Dell. Happy to be here.
Thanks. Thank you for joining us today. Hey, listen, before we dive in, let me ask you a kind of an innocuous question. How's the weather in Tahoe?
Yeah, it's been a pretty epic winter, that's for sure. I don't think we've had this large of a winter since I've been here, and I've been up here for about 32 years now, I believe. And I've cleared out the driveway for way too many times to count.
Wow, you guys are just getting pounded. That's incredible. But So we feel your pain, but not that much, I guess.
We should, I would like to mention to our listeners that there's nothing we enjoy more than talking about a book. And it's even more pleasurable when you can talk to the guy who wrote it.
Yeah,
I'm excited to have the opportunity to talk to Bruce. So,
listen, let me say right off, I just absolutely loved Refraction. I really didn't want it to end. That's no joke. I could relate to just so much of it, even though my kind of similar entry into adulthood was 20 years earlier than you. So anyway, this story took place in the 80s, this memoir. But let's go back a little further in time. You said your father instilled a strong work ethic in you, Bruce. Tell us a little bit about both sides of your family. Where'd they come from and how they ended up settling where they did?
We have a strong San Francisco Bay Area roots on my mom's side of the family. My grandfather, Oscar Peterson, actually traveled here from Sweden to Ellis Island and ended up migrating into Oakland down in the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. And it was just a few months after the 1906 earthquake, actually. And he worked as a mill hand. So he did a lot of woodworking, and it's pretty interesting. I remember when he would play poker at the table, he had two fingers missing on one hand and three fingers missing on the other. And I said, Grandpa, how'd that happen? Oh, I worked in a mill. So it was really interesting for me as a kid watching him shuffle the cards. It just blew me away.
He could still do it though, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That's great.
But he was very good with his hands. He was a woodworker. We have some of his furniture around the house now that he made from hand. And I actually have his old hand plane that he used for shaping wood. It's in my office here, and I keep it here just as a reminder kind of our roots. He eventually moved up to Lake County in Northern California, and so all my uncles were farmers, and they used to take me hunting and fishing all the time, and very rural type community. And so I grew up in the Bay Area, but I spent a lot of weekends up in the hills with them.
You got some time being an outdoors guy as well as being a Bay Area guy, right? Nice.
Exactly. Nice. Exactly. And my father, he was also from, or he was from Oakland, and he worked at a service station and later at the Southern Pacific Railroad before he got drafted into World War II. And he served only for a short time in the war. Let out, and he got educated through the GI Bill, completed classes in electrical engineering, and later he worked at the Naval Air Station in Alameda, and he used to take me over there on the weekends, Alameda Base, and I'd see all the fighter planes and everything, and he was also mechanically very adept. He helped me learn how to work on cars, and along with my brother ended up managing three service stations, shell stations down the Bay Area, and also a Goodyear shop. So that was my summertime employment as a teenager. So I got to know how to work on cars and do a lot of that. And Dad was good around the house, of course, in electronics. We built his own, some of his own TV sets. And this was kind of back in the day where they still had tubes too. And I remember going out.
Right.
I remember going out in the garage and seeing boxes of tubes. So that was kind of my background. We always were always kind of working on cars, and you know, just a lot of people in our family were very good with their hands.
So you worked at a service station as a summer job, basically?
Yeah. I started working when I was about 13, I think I was.
I was going to say, let's take it up to the 80s. Now you're in college. You needed a summer job.
Yeah.
And you had an uncle who was able to get you a job with a merchant marine company that was supporting the maintenance of the Alaska pipeline, which had been completed about, I don't know, 8 or 10 years before that, I guess. So what were your initial thoughts about this new summer job? Were you apprehensive, excited? How'd you feel about kind of leaving the world, or had you thought about it even at that point?
Well, it was very exciting, and it was somewhat unexpected too, because I remember asking my uncle. My dad said, "Oh, you should talk to your Uncle Jim." At the time, I was a geology major at University of Colorado. And he said, "Well, you know, your uncle, his company does a lot of work for the oil companies." And at the time, I was majoring in paleontology. So I thought, "Oh, if I could get an internship with one of the oil companies, that'd be great. I'd get some experience."
Yeah.
And so I did ask my uncle, and he called me back in a couple of weeks. He said, "Well, can't get you on anything with the oil companies, but there's a tugboat and barge operation up on the north slope of Alaska. Would you be interested?" And of course, I said, "Of course." And then I heard the pay, and the pay was really good, especially for a college student.
Okay.
And yeah, so it was a excitement and kind of a jump in both feet approach. You know, I always kind of think back to when I was a kid and you get on the roller coaster and you get in the cart and it's too late to turn back. You know, you can't turn back now. You just hold on. Yeah, that's kind of the feeling I had, you know, and I had a very romantic view of working on the North Slope. And when we flew out of Fairbanks and first saw the Trans-Alaska pipeline, it was really impactful. And then when we landed in Dead Horse, that's when it really set in. And I really had no idea what I was getting into. It was quite a surprise.
So tell us a little bit about Prudhoe Bay and Dead Horse and what it was like showing up in that place. And tell us a little bit about the how your the company you work for serviced the pipeline, kind of looking at the big picture.
Yeah, just to kind of set the scene, Alaska's North Slope, it's the area north of the Brooks Range, and there's two Arctic Ocean seas. There's the Chukchi Sea to the west of Point Barrow and the Beaufort Sea to the east. And the Beaufort Sea is where we sail mostly, includes Prudhoe Bay. And the location is 300 miles north of the Arctic Circle, so it's as far north as you can go.
That's way up there.
Yeah, exactly. And I mentioned landing in Dead Horse in my book, and it might sound familiar because recently it was in the news. That was where one of the balloons were shot down between Dead Horse and Kaktovik. And it was kind of funny because in my book, I made a comment, or I had heard a comment by the union personnel director when I was in Seattle. And he said, "Well, it's not the end of the Prudhoe Bay, it's not the end of the world, but you sure as hell can see it from there."
That
always stuck with me. And when they had that CNN news story, it was kind of funny because they had interviewed a colonel on there, and he said, "You know, you have to keep in mind it's a very remote location." And he said, "I've been up there before. for the Air Force. He was in the Air Force, and he says it's bleak. He said it's literally the end of the world. And I thought, all right, yeah.
That's it. You got it. You were there. Yeah, yeah, I did. I saw the CNN thing on TV, and it's the dead horse. I said, I know exactly where that is, or at least I've heard about it. So, yeah, it's amazing. So yeah, listen, yeah. So once you settled in, so what were your duties here to start? And
The company I worked for was Arctic Marine Freighters, AMF, and it was run by Crowley Maritime, which was one of the largest maritime corporations in the world. And the camp was located past the oil fields at the end of a gravel causeway, and the causeway stretched out into Prudhoe Bay. So again, I was as far north as you can go.
North of Prudhoe Bay, even.
Yes.
Well, you were sticking out into it anyway.
Exactly. As far as you could go. Yeah. When I first got up there, it was pretty monotonous. You know, it was a lot of grunt work. All the equipment is buried in snow. So that's why I kind of laugh now when people are kind of griping a little bit about shoveling snow. We shoveled out like barges and boats and everything. It doesn't get a lot of snow up in the Arctic. It's actually in an Arctic desert, but it gets these big drifts. So anything sticking up out of from the surface, you get these big snow drifts.
It's gonna catch it.
So my pretty much all my timesheets were 12 hours a day of shoveling snow for about a month solid. And then after that, I learned how to run a forklift. And then after that, all the boats were dry docked on top of the barges. So they were on big wood blocks. So we would have to prep the boats before they were serviceable. And that meant grinding the hulls, chipping all the paint on the whole boat and prepping it, priming it, and painting them, getting them all completely ready to hit the water. So that was about another month of grind work. And I think that's probably when I decided, I think I want to sail.
Because yeah.
When they first went into the water, it was just something, and seeing people out there working on them, I thought, I got to get my Merchant Marine Mariner's license.
So the whole objective of the Merchant Marine there was to prepare all the equipment for when the ice thawed, so you can move stuff in and out of there. Was that the idea?
Yeah, it's the big operation was called Sea Lift, and that's when barges would come up from Houston, sometimes a couple from San Francisco, mostly from Seattle. And there'd be about 25 to 30 barges filled with what you call modules, and the drill modules. It's equipment for the oil fields. And they would usually back up around Point Barrow. And once the ice receded from Barrow, they were able to make it around and then come into Prudhoe. And our job was to assist them into West Dock and help unload all the equipment. So that was a major endeavor every year towards the end of the summer. But then there were also a lot of other jobs, shuttling surveyors for drill operations, or transporting equipment out to drill rigs. And we also created islands for exploratory drills. We created Muckluck Island up in Prudhoe Bay, and Muckluck Island was kind of infamous. That was the most expensive dry hole in oil industry history. Cost over $1 billion. And it was an exploratory well that came up dry.
Ooh.
Yeah. But we were on that gravel haul for several weeks. I was on a boat constructing that island.
This is kind of a little teaser, the story he's telling here. But the way he put that into words, into his book, it is a clear picture of all this. And it's, I mean, the portion that I've already read encompasses some of this. I got to remind our listeners that to go ahead and pick up the book. This is a fascinating story, and he's telling it rather lightly. It's amazing how he paints a picture in words. So just remind everybody, this is a book that they can read firsthand.
Yeah, again, I thought the way you captured like the immensity, the vastness of the place, and kind of the monotony of the place and the monotony of the jobs, it was you really painted a clear picture in my mind. It was really great to read.
Thank you.
I was also going to say, Dave, that how he was able to remember all this. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, I know he took a lot of pictures, which is also included in the book. And you explained each one of those. Thank you very much. I said, how did he remember all this stuff? I mean, the way you describe some of the minute details of your life there, I thought it was a great story, a great read. It was a tremendous book. I enjoyed it a lot, Bruce. I really did.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Listen, you'd been there a couple months. You're shoveling snow, chipping paint. Did you ever say, boy, I wonder if I made a big mistake here, or was the money good enough that you just kept doing it?
Yeah, you know, that first day when I walked into the living quarters, I thought I had made a mistake. I didn't think I was going to make it, to be honest. You know, I looked around the room, and it was probably, 10 by 10 or 10 by 15 foot room, not bigger than much of a standard bedroom, but it had two bunk beds and then lockers. And I thought, there's four guys that live in this room. And then I looked and there was water pouring down from the top of the ceiling in a puddle at the bottom. And I was like, I don't know about this.
Not exactly the Ritz.
No. And basically they're almost like trailer units on top of each other. Yeah, it was tough. But then once I met my roommates, they were really good guys. And
all ended up being pretty compatible.
Yeah, we got along well. Oh, and it was good. And I got to meet all the people the next day. My boss was Bill Payne. He was known as the Bear. He had a growl for a voice.
The Bear, I love that, Bear. The Bear. Yeah.
And Jack Bork was a foreman, and Lee, who took me under his wing, he was the kind of the guy that led all the grunts and
tell
taught
us,
them.
You got a quick Lee story you could tell us? I really enjoyed listening to that guy's stories.
Yeah, Lee was great. I mean, the minute I met him, he broke into a bear hunting story right off the bat. Uh-huh. I'm just like, who is this guy? And he was a bear guide up in Washington, and he just told this very colorful story. I'm like, oh my gosh. I go, well, this will help pass the time, you know. But he was a lot of experience. He had sailed around the world three times. He had fought in several wars. He was in a close call in the Coral Sea, Battle of the Coral Sea. He was blown off the deck of a oiler, what they call an oiler. A ship. It was a ship. It was a USS Neosho. And it was a fuel tanker that supported the rest of the fleet. And he talked about that and said he was on the side. And he goes, yeah, I was looking and these bombs were coming in. And, you know, you could see them kind of sideways. And then you knew you weren't going to get hit. And he goes, I saw this one come in and it was a perfect circle. And he said, the next thing I knew, he goes, I was laying on my back and I looked down the deck and my shoes were 15 feet away from me.
Wow. Jeez. I loved his stories, man. Oh man. You're lucky. Hey, listen, let me ask you about a close call or two that you had. I know you talk about two, I'll call them near death experiences. And one, you knew you were in big trouble immediately, but there were other people around to help you. Now, the other one was maybe not as traumatic initially, I don't know, but you were all alone. So I'm wondering if you could read a passage describing that second one. I can set the scene for you. So it was you and a coworker had been assigned to clean out, you called them mucking out, the interior of a barge. Now, you had to open a manhole cover, and then you went down a ladder into the belly of the barge. And you're keeping your fingers crossed that you didn't have any oxygen-starved pockets in this it was really pitch black because of the continual oxidation and rusting, it would rob oxygen from the air. So I know you guys worked till lunchtime, and then your partner decided to take a break. He left the barge. You said you'd be along shortly. So can you take it from there?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, the scene starts off, as you say, I was in the belly of a barge working, so we'll start from there. The totality of the void felt as though it was something tangible, as if it held its own undeterminable weight and mass. It felt as though I could reach out and touch it, hold on to the complete nothingness, and feel the complexity of everything I lacked. Somewhere in the void, there was indeed something. I called into the black entombment, hello? Complete silence. And I heard my voice. Shit, I mumbled and stood up. This is way too fucking early in the season to let my mind spiral off. I climbed the ladder out of the belly of the barge, squinting as I crawled out of the manhole. A deep breath of frigid air and the moan of the camp generator helped ground my consciousness. I made my way to the bow of the barge. The expanse of the frozen sea stretched to the shoreline in the same shade of gray as the sky above. I thought of putting together a warm lunch in the galley as I leapt toward the snowdrift with a pack trail to the point of Liktok. My foot fell short of the lip. I attempted to reach out with both hands, too late. I was already hurtling into the chasm between the ice and barge. My downward progress stopped abruptly at the bottom, where the ice and steel hull of the barges met. The snowdrift, having formed against the bow but now separated by several feet, arced downward like the bottom of a large bowl, mirroring the curvature of the bow. I reached down and felt my legs, ankles, and feet. No need to panic, nothing broken. I assessed the situation, stuck between a layer of ice compressed against an island on one side and wedged against a 200-foot-long barge on the other. The bottom of the crevice was only about a half foot wide where my boots were bent, toes up. The barge could pop free of the ice at any moment, shift, and crush me in a split second. They say your life flashes before your eyes, near the moment of death, but I'm not sure that is completely true. I didn't think of how I wouldn't see any of my friends and loved ones again. Childhood memories didn't pass by like film highlights. I'll bet that given time to think it over, the same thing went through the minds of most people faced with the possibility of their demise, as was going through mine at that moment. I needed to get the hell out of here as fast as possible. No time for life reruns. My boots slid against the ice with each step I attempted. Zero traction. I could feel the cold steel against my back. My breath quickened, and puffs of steam spiraled from my mouth and nose. My heart pounded against the can of chewing tobacco in my top coverall pocket. I yelled out a few times, but knew Steve was back in our room getting higher and had already made his way to the Liktok for lunch. My voice sounded frantic and flat in the confines of the compacted space, like a babbling car sales commercial on a mono radio. Fuck. Trying to turn my body, it wedged in tighter. The dangerous situation was quickly getting worse. I had never experienced claustrophobia, but I also had never found myself pinned between a barge and a wall of ice either. I jerked my shoulders back and forth and could finally spin my body around. Deep breath. My back was now to the ice and boots against the bow. My biggest fear was slipping farther down into the narrowing gap between the ice and barge and becoming permanently stuck. I did not want to be found that way. I also realized I was exerting too much strength in my struggle to claw my way out. A calmer, more concentrated effort would probably yield better results. Pushing against the bow of the barge with both hands and feet in equal pressure and pressing my back against the frozen wall, I slowly slid my way up the surface of the curved ice. I thought of how fast I had slid down, to compare to how slow I was, inching my way upward. Gravity's a bitch on a slippery slope of metal and ice. Approaching the top, I made my move. Pushing as hard as I could with both feet, I crested the lip of the frozen drift and spun around on my stomach. Did the Inupiat have a name for being crushed by steel and ice? I rested for a few seconds until my cheek became numb from lying on the drift, and I lifted my head. The lagoon stretched to the gravel shoreline about 100 yards away. In a few weeks, the glistening sheets of ice would be nothing more than fractured chunks drifting aimlessly along the spiraling Beaufort Gyre of the Arctic Ocean, each one dependent on ever-shifting winds and tides.
That's really, that's scary. He described the whole thing so well. The other one, of course, you went through the ice, but you had people there. And to me, this was scarier. I don't know. I don't know how you felt, but this was like, uh-oh, man, I could be, I'm all alone here.
I thought both were pretty scary, Dave.
Yeah.
I thought both situations.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, both of them.
Yeah. Either one, it could have been the wrap-up, anyhow.
Yeah.
I tell my, when I used to tell my kids those stories, I would kind of laugh about it and they would go, Dad, it's not funny. We might not have been here.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. So looking at the whole experience here, did it make you a different person today? Would you, if you hadn't done that, would you be the same person you are today? Did it change you? Did it refocus you?
Yeah, definitely. You know, and my wife will mention that sometimes too, after she read read the book, she goes, oh, now I understand some of the things you do, you know, just, and I think I gained a stronger worldview too. You know, I was really interested in traveling at the time, and one of the coworkers up there was from Yugoslavia, and he kind of told me his story of growing up over there and in some of the challenges they had. He went on to work for a large Russian oil company called Rosneft. Kind of followed him, but seeing the worldview and the power of big money and industry was really eye-opening. And of course, working the long hours, it built a strong work ethic, 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, at least, you know. Mm-hmm. During sea lift, I went 3 days one time without a break. I would just break, you know, short nap in wherever I could find a place to sleep, you know. Wow. Sometimes a forklift or whatever, but pretty much worked 3 days straight. And of course, I learned a lot about shoveling snow.
That too, huh? Well, I really enjoyed the fact that you kind of weaved some history and ecology through the story. You gave us some history of the area, and I also got the feeling that you were kind of torn between a sense of environmentalism on the one hand and pragmatism on the other hand, that, hey, I need a job, we need energy. Your thoughts the same? Do you have the same balance now versus back then when you're looking back?
Yeah, and that's what kind of changed too. When I wrote the piece, I wanted to have a lot of reflection, because the way I viewed the industry back then, you know, you justify it a lot. And Lee was good about that too. He said, look at the city, they raised the pipeline so the caribou herds can go underneath it. It doesn't bother them at all. And, you know, and mm-hmm. had that kind of view. And I looked around and I said, yeah, it seems like they're trying to be sensitive. But then as you go along, I think it was when I saw my first sea lift and saw the power of the oil companies, what they could do. They could do pretty much anything, you know, and it was very interesting. And also at that time, you know, you heard a little bit about greenhouse gases, but not much. That was kind of back page stuff. You know, now with global warming, I mean, we just know so much more. I'm also a writer. I do a lot of writing for Native American tribes. A couple of my colleagues have family members that were at Standing Rock. And, you know, we all know the history going on there with DAPL and everything. And so, yeah, I've changed my view quite a bit in looking mm-hmm. at things, but the world has changed. You know, we know more now too. And I think it's my friend, also a friend of mine who read the book, he said he found it interesting that it's actually three stories: a story of my personal experience in the Arctic, the story of my life outside the Arctic over the passage of time now, and the story of the demise of our planet.
Yeah, I think that really captures it all. Absolutely.
Let everybody know it's a fantastic story. It's a great book. I'd recommend anybody that can get a hold of it to read it.
We're gonna put a link to your to where they can buy the book, Homebound Publishing, and we're gonna put a link to your website also, Bruce. Thank you very much for being here. I wish we could talk longer. I had a lot more questions to ask you here. This was great. I certainly endorse the book and urge everybody to get it and read it.
Well, thanks so much, Dave and Dell. I just love your podcast, Two Old Guys. It's great.
Two old guys.
They're excellent. And I just I look forward to hearing stories from future guests. I really enjoyed Bridie's story. She's such a strong writer. And yeah, I'm going back in some of your archives and listening to some of the others. So thank you for all your great work.
All right, man. Take care. We'll see you all next time.
Thank you, everybody. Old Buck Dell saying, see you next time.